near the fishing spot. Edgar had anointed himself with off and begun to doze, the dog stretched out around him, alligator-like. Clouds unfolded and unfolded beyond the treetops. Waves passed through the reeds at the water's edge. Hush, hush. And timbreless voices piped across the water.
Mom, where's that shovel?
I thought I told you not to do that.
Laughter. A delighted toddler's long scree. Go fill this up from the lake. Car doors slamming, dishes clanking, bottles breaking.
Not in the car, you won't.
Babu lay whimpering and jerking his leg, dreaming of voles running along weedy tunnels. In his dream, he'd shrunken to their size and bounded after them, blades of grass passing swiftly as he gained. But he was full-size, too, inside and outside the tunnel, big and small at the same time. And likewise with the other dogs, drafting the warm afternoon into their chests and exhaling sighs, dreaming and listening to the whoosh and slosh of water and the wind in the trees. At first the dogs had thought they'd left home on a lark and would soon return. Now it seemed their world had come unmoored, and their home traveled with them, while the earth turned beneath their feet. Creek, forest, marsh edge, lake, moon, wind. The sun presently baking them through the treetops. Back at the kennel, they'd slept near Edgar many times. In the mow, in his room in the house, even in the yard. But it had never been like these recent nights. Never curled beside him so intimately that his thrashing drove them to their feet, where they stood and watched him struggle against some unseen threat. It raised their hackles. They dropped their heads beneath their shoulders and grumbled and peered around. So vulnerable he was with his blue skin in the moonlight and his arm twisted over his face and blood pulsing beneath his skin. At such times, only Esse wandered off, hunting in the dark. They worried when he walked off for food. They argued among themselves. He's gone. He'll come back. What if he doesn't? What happens then? He will. Oft times, in his absence, the trees bent round, carrying their freight of jays and squirrels, engrossed in bitter dispute. Sometimes he returned, bearing delicacies unknown before. Sometimes he came empty-handed, but ready to play. That afternoon, they'd set their fretting aside. The place was familiar. There was nothing to do but flick away flies and let the sun pass. Edgar half slept, more hypnotized even by the afternoon sun than they. He didn't catch the scent that drifted into the clearing, nor react to the sounds that, one after another, the dogs heard. It wasn't until they leapt up, Esse first, then Tinder, and then, in a big scramble of leaves, Babu, that Edgar finally woke and stood and saw what had happened. By the time the younger of the two girls reached the glade, she and her companion had long since talked themselves out. They came to a driveway cut into the woods that ended at a red cottage. A car was parked in the weeds, but no one seemed to be home. They picked their way through the woods and along the shoreline looking for a sandy spot until they found the spit of land, and there the older girl walked out and sat with her back to a tree and looked across the water at the campgrounds. The younger girl dawdled her way along the reeds and sedge. She came upon a fisherman's satchel and a child's fishing rod propped against a tree. She looked around. There was a clearing in the woods, penetrated by a shaft of sunlight, and she wandered in that direction, hoping to spot the white, three-petaled trillium blossoms that were her favorites. The boy was already watching her when she looked up. He was standing on the far side of the clearing, tall and limber-looking, with thick shocks of hair hanging across his forehead and over his eyes, all of which suggested youth, though in the bright sun his face seemed lined like an old man's. A heartbeat later, she saw the three animals standing around him, one forward and one at either side. Wolves, she thought. But of course they weren't. They were dogs, Shepherds, maybe, though not any kind she'd seen before. Their coats were chestnut and black, and their tails swept down to trace the extension of their hind legs. But what struck her most was the poised stillness of their bodies, and especially their gaze, fixed on her and unwavering. Then the boy gestured, and the dogs were whisking through the clearing. One leapt away into the woods. The other two bounded toward her in an unswerving line, their shoulders rolling lion-like, and their backs bowing and stretching. The sight made her gasp. When she looked up, the boy was pointing at her. He pressed an upright finger to his lips, then held the flat of his palm out in a way that clearly meant she should be quiet and stand still. The two dogs that had crossed the clearing came to a halt in front of her, left and right. They didn't look unfriendly, but they didn't look completely benevolent either. She took an instinctive step back, and from behind her came a disquieting rumble. She froze and turned her head. The third dog stood with its muzzle at the back of her knee. It nosed her leg and looked at her. When she put her foot back where it had been, the dogs in front of her stepped closer, and that made her sway a little, as if she were pinched in a slowly tightening vise. Yet as soon as she'd regained her balance and stood still, the dog stepped back again. She looked across the clearing. The boy was gone. Now, from behind her, she heard the older girl's voice.
"Jess, let's go. Jess."
The girl wanted to reply, but she couldn't tell what the dogs would do if she started hollering. Besides, there was something fascinating about the way they had lasered in on her, the way they stood just out of arm's reach. She had the distinct sense that the dogs just wanted to keep her still. And they were beautiful, with furrowed, honey-colored brows over brown eyes that shone with an extraordinary sense of, what, concern? Serene concern. She wondered what would happen if she talked to them. Would they step forward and touch her? She was about to test this idea when she heard a sharp double clap. Instantly, the dog to her right dropped away, oozing into motion and disappearing into the bushes. A moment later, the dog behind her wheeled and vanished as well. But the third dog didn't move. It stood looking at her, then stepped forward and sniffed the hem of her shorts, quivering. She held out her hand. The dog stepped back with a look of something like guilt on its face. Then it, too, bolted. She craned her neck to watch it move, so graceful and sure-footed. A dozen yards away, the two other dogs waited beside the boy, who was kneeling and gesturing to draw the last dog toward him. When it arrived, the boy's hands flashed expertly along its sides and down its legs, as if checking, out of long habit, for injuries. The little fishing rod she'd seen earlier lay on the ground near him, and the satchel was looped over his shoulder. He stood. The dogs looked at her across their flanks one last time, and then they were gone, and the underbrush had flicked back into place. She let out her breath.
"I should be scared, but I'm not," she thought.
And, strangely, nothing like this will ever happen to me again. She waited another moment, then let out a whoop and raced toward the sound of the older girl's voice. He kept them moving until it had grown so dark he couldn't see the way. Long ago, on their first night of running, the sky had been clear and a full moon had shone directly overhead, but now the moon was a waxing crescent. He chose a spot near a stand of jack pines and scraped together needles, tossing away any resinous clumps. He downed the dogs. They knew it meant no water or food for the night, and a chorus of grunts and complaints followed. 4.5 days at Scotia Lake. They should have been pushing west and north, but instead they'd lingered where the food was easy, at the risk of being spotted. He'd known it was a mistake even as they'd done it. The howling had been bad enough the night of the fireworks, but now the little blonde girl had gotten a good long look at him, and an even better look at the dogs. He'd heard her shout as they were running from the clearing.
"Hey, Diane! Diane, over here! Oh, my God! You're never going to believe this!"
Whoever Diane was, she'd believe it, all right. She'd believe it, and her parents would believe it, and the county sheriff's office would believe it, too. There was nothing to do but move as far and as fast as possible, and always keep away from the roads. The old plan. The only plan he'd ever had. They'd covered maybe 2 miles as the light waned. If they pushed hard the next day, they could cover another 3 or 4 straight through the forest. There was some good news, at least. The Zebco fishing rig, being a stubby affair, had survived their mad dash. Once they'd crossed the forest road, Edgar had cut off the hook and embedded it in the makeshift cardboard hookbook he kept in his back pocket. Afterward, he managed to thread the rod through the underbrush by tucking it under his arm. The other good news was how perfectly the dogs had translated the guarding game. It had been lovely to see them move through the sunlight toward the little girl. Part of Edgar had wanted to stand and watch them. Once they had surrounded her, whenever she moved, whenever she even shifted her weight, one of them pressured her back into place. And when it was time to run, they'd kept close and quiet. Essay lay with her head beside Edgar's knee. He listened to her stomach growl and began the arithmetic again. On foot, breaking a trail and having to sidetrack for food and water, they might advance 3 solid miles a day. 90 miles in a month. It was early July. He hoped it wasn't more than 100 miles to the Canadian border. That put them where he wanted to go by mid-August. He was going to need a map soon. They were still in the Shawamigan, but if they made steady progress, they wouldn't be for long. The next morning a mist began to fall, so fine it coalesced in beads on the dog's fur. By noon the mist had turned to rain, and when a high-skirted pine presented itself, they scuttled beneath to wait out the weather. Half an hour later the pelting rain was deafening. Sheets of water swept across their knee-high vista. Their adopted trees shed water erratically. Without warning, a chilly gush would cascade through the core of the tree and onto their backs. When he was willing to take on more water, Edgar poked his head from beneath the tree's hem to look for a break in the clouds. The dogs alternated between groaned complaints and half-sleep, trotting into the rain to urinate and returning, shaking out at the fringe of the tree, or sometimes, to everyone's displeasure, beneath it. The air beneath the pine began to reek of wet dog. After a while, Edgar could find no position that was both comfortable and dry. His bones began to ache. Only Babu passed the time with equanimity, head on paws, hypnotized by the sight of falling water, sometimes even rolling on his back to watch the proceedings upside down. At first, Edgar's thoughts were practical. They needed to keep moving. He measured his own hunger to gauge how the dogs must feel. He'd gained a sense for how long they could go without. Skipping a day, he thought, would leave them distracted but not in danger. They were used to a little hunger now. In fact, except for the discomfort, there wasn't anything particularly wrong with spending a day sitting under a tree. Hadn't they done pretty much exactly that for the previous 3 days? But something in his mind made him fidget as the day passed, something he didn't want to think about. For the first time since they'd crossed the creek at the back of their land, he felt genuinely homesick. And once that began, the litany of memories quickly overwhelmed him. His bed, the sound of the creaky stairs, the smell of the kennel, which their time beneath the tree was reminding him of ever more powerfully, the truck, the apple trees, surely heavy with green fruit by now, his mother, despite the tumult of emotions surrounding her in his mind. And most ferociously, he missed Almandine. Her image appeared accompanied by a spasm of pure wretchedness. The dogs with him were fine dogs, astonishing dogs, but they weren't Almandine, who bore his soul. Yet he kept making plans to go farther away from her, and he didn't know when he would ever be back. He couldn't go back. His last image of her was that despondent posture, lying in the kitchen, tracking him with her eyes as he turned away. Her muzzle had grayed so in the last year. Once upon a time, she had bounded down the stairs ahead of him and waited at the bottom. Lately, there had been mornings when she'd tried to stand but failed, and he'd lifted her hindquarters and walked alongside as she navigated the steps. But what she'd lost in agility, she'd gained in perception, in her capacity to peer into him. How had he forgotten that? How had he forgotten that in the months after his father's death, she alone could console him, nosing him at precisely the instant to break some spiral of despair? How had he forgotten that some days she'd saved him simply by leaning against him? She was the only other being in the world who missed his father as much as he did, and he'd walked away from her. Why hadn't he understood that? What had he been thinking? He needed only to close his eyes to feel all over again the sensation of his father's hands reaching into him, the certainty that his heart was about to stop. The memory was too dazzling, like the memory of being born, something that, if recalled in full, would destroy a person. He couldn't separate it from the image of his father lying on the kennel floor, mouth agape, and that final exhalation Edgar had pressed from his body. Then he thought of Claude, and the look on his face when Essa had trotted up to him with the syringe in her mouth, and of the white dandelion and the patch of white grass that had surrounded it. And he thought of Dr. Papineau, eyes open and head turned at the bottom of the workshop stairs. He was stumbling through the rain before he knew what he was doing. He didn't care what direction he traveled, only that he moved. When he looked down, the dogs were bounding alongside. His wet clothes had warmed the temperature of his body, but the rain flushed away the heat. He flung himself through the brush, bursting through thickets, stumbling and standing and running again. For the first time since they'd left home, true meadows appeared. Twice they crossed gravel roads, strange unbroken lines of rusty mud. All of it washed through him, washed the thoughts away. The rain became a senseless tapping on his skin, neither warm nor cold, and he welcomed it. A July rain should never have stopped them. The danger had been in staying still so long. They encountered many fences now, some downed and rusty and more dangerous because they were difficult to see. He stripped blueberries from their stems wherever he found them and held them out to the dogs, who rolled them in their mouths and reluctantly swallowed. The cardboard holding the fish hooks dissolved in his pocket, and the hooks began to poke his skin. He spent an hour standing naked from the waist down, extracting the hooks and wrapping them in layers of birch bark. And when he finished, his fingertips were puckered and raw. Near twilight, the clouds fractured and the rain let up. Tracts of deep blue appeared in the sky. They were within sight of a small hayfield of perhaps 50 acres, at the far end of which stood a lone old barn. He stripped off his sodden clothes and bedded them down inside the edge of the woods. Before any but the brightest stars shone, the four of them lay overlapped and sleeping at the rim of the Shawamigan. When he woke in the morning, he didn't understand that the dogs were gone, or even how late it was, only that 1,000 pounds of sand covered each of his limbs. He lay on his back, arm draped over his face, letting the radiant sun warm his chest and arms. The absence of the dog's soft weight against his body meant nothing. There was only the dreamer's logic, wishing a return to the sea dreams from which he'd run aground. When his eyes finally came open, he stared at the flattened weeds where Tinder should have been sleeping, and pushed himself upright and looked around. Before him lay a field gone to wild grass and milkweed. It rolled in a long upsweep to the barn he'd seen the evening before. Two hawks glided over the field, hunting and diving. One of the dogs, Essay, porpoised out of the weeds in the middle of the field, and the others followed, arcing and disappearing into the deep grass. He stood and clapped, and they worked their way across the field, zigzagging and leaping, until at last Esse burst into the clear. She carried in her jaws an enormous brown and black garter snake, thick in the belly and almost as long as she. She stopped near Edgar and shook it until its lifeless body writhed in the air. Babu and Tinder whisked past, trying to snatch her prize. She trotted one way, then another, until finally Timber got hold of the snake's tail. After a struggle, the snake separated into two parts, with a string of entrails quivering between. Babu and Tinder repeated the process with the rear half of the snake until each dog retreated with their portion. Ugh, God, Edgar thought, turning away. Not so much disgusted by the idea of their eating a snake, though garter snakes smelled foul, as they're eating it raw. He wondered if the matches in his pocket were still dry. He could cook the snake for them. But by the time he'd dressed, nothing was going to be left. The dogs had to be ravenous, if his own stomach was any indication. Nothing else felt half as important as finding food. He dressed in his damp clothes and gathered the dogs, and they waded up through quack grass and milkweed and mullein. The dogs skating around him in wild, hooped orbits, improvised on the theme of his path. The old barn stood beside a weed-shot blacktop road with no house in sight. It was the first barn they'd seen in their travels, and Edgar took it as a sign they had finally crossed the Shawamigan and were in farmland again. He pressed his eye to one of the thumb-wide spaces in the barn siding boards. Inside sat a disc harrow and a moldboard plow, each with its spooned metal seat, and a dilapidated hay wagon whose framework back sagged like a frowning thespian mask. At the far end, an antique sower made of rusty knives and funnels. Irregular planes of light striped the machinery and the hay-strewn dirt floor as if he were looking through the ribs of a great bird-picked carcass at whatever had eaten it from within and been trapped. The dogs ignored the barn and poked along the dilapidated barbed-wire fence bordering the road, nosing the fireweed and morning glory, twisting up the fence posts. Edgar walked the pavement, not even the shadow of a center line. The dogs were acting downright gay, he thought, watching them run toward him as if relieved to have returned to the itinerant life after being pinned down in the rain. They crossed a shallow ditch together and passed through a line of trees, where an orderly, two-stranded barbed-wire fence stood. The dogs slipped beneath, hardly breaking stride. Before them stood an upsloping field of sunflowers, taller than Edgar. Row upon row of sage trunks topped by hairy, fluted plates, all pointed off-angle to the risen sun. They walked the edge of the sunflowers for easy traveling until a car appeared distantly on the blacktop. Edgar turned for one last look at the desiccated barn, then clapped his leg, and they ducked into the gap between two infinitely receding rows of sunflower stalks. Outside Loot. They were halfway down the far side of the field before the sunflowers dwindled into an open patch, and Edgar stopped to look around. At the bottom of the slope, the field ended at a tree-filled farmyard. The house was simple and square, with attic dormers and plain brown asphalt shingling. A long driveway hooked around behind the house to stop at a freestanding building that looked like a carriage house or shed. In front of the shed sat a battered old car. No one was walking around. No dogs lay on the back porch. No sound emanated from the small barn at the back of the yard. All they could hear was the collective hum of thousands of bees harvesting the sticky nectar glinting on the sunflower heads. The field itself was long and narrow, an alley bounded on one side by a barbed wire fence and on the other by a solid stretch of woods. Over the treetops rose a water tower, aquamarine and round-bellied. Wide-spaced cumulus clouds languished above it all in shades of white and blue, their shadows tracing the contoured land. The name of the town was painted on the water tower's barrel in tall white letters. Loot. He clapped the dogs over and held their muzzles in his hand, and ran his fingertips around their gums to see how thirsty they were. It gave him a chance to gauge whether Essay was in the mood to bolt or to stick, whether Tinder or Babu were fretful. When he was satisfied that they would stay nearby, when the four of them agreed on that, they made their way to the edge of the field. During his thief's apprenticeship, Edgar had learned not to waste much time speculating on whether a place was unoccupied or just looked that way. It was easiest to just walk up and knock. If someone stirred inside, he could always run off. And, too, his hunger made him reckless. He downstayed the dogs. Essay walked it down, inch by inch. They were going to have to practice that. And strode his most innocent walk to the back door. He heard no voices inside, no television, no radio. The sash on the small square window beside the door was down and latched. He knocked. When a minute passed, long enough for someone to get out of bed and start walking across the room, long enough for someone to shout, "Who is it?" long enough for a dog to bark, he opened the screen door and tested the inside knob. To his surprise, the door swung inward, and he stood looking into a neat linoleumed kitchen with a Christmas floor mat just inside. He leaned in and knocked again, louder this time. The only reply was the click of the refrigerator compressor shutting off. He took one more look around, and then it was a mad dash. He threw open the refrigerator. Cans of beer and bottles of Coca-Cola. He grabbed a Coke and rummaged through the cabinet drawers until he found a bottle opener and upended the cold bottle against his lips. From the counter near the door, he grabbed a loaf of bread and a bag of potato chips and stepped outside and tried to stroll along, though he knew, in his excitement, he was heel-walking like a dope. A patch of weeds near the edge of the field began to shake. He dove in, awkwardly signing a release before the dogs broke anyway. They weren't idiots. They knew food and they saw it coming. He ripped open the plastic wrapper on the bread and handed out slices all around. He gobbled one down himself, then another, following it with big washes of Coke. In a minute, half the bread was gone. He tore open the bag of chips and shoveled them in, chip after salty, crunchy chip. The dogs tried to jam their snouts into the bag. He clamped it shut, then parceled out the delights, with the dogs following his hand each time it disappeared. He smiled, bits of potato chip and bread showing in his teeth. The true depth of his hunger had only then become evident. The sight of all that food almost panicked him. He needed to take something modest or he'd have fainted right there in the kitchen. He sat watching the house again, half expecting someone to barge out of the door at last, shouting and shaking a fist. The dogs panted in his face as if to say, "What are you waiting for?" Then they broke into a sprint. There was no holding back. Whoever lived there might come back at any moment and the opportunity would be lost. This was not going to be elegant, he thought. The dogs hadn't been inside a house, or any building for that matter, for many weeks. They circled skittishly at the threshold until he shooed them in. They entered, slinking. He filled a big plastic bowl with tap water and put it down. They leapt forward and slobbered up the water. Spookiness vanished, while he rifled the cupboards, setting food aside as he discovered it. When he opened the refrigerator, his gaze fell on a package wrapped in white butcher paper. The purple-inked label read, "Bratwurst." They ate like starved kings. They would be gone in a few minutes and never see the place again, and he fed them all as much as they could hold. He carried the bratwurst to the back door and tore the paper and spilled the rubbery links across the planks of the stoop. Even before they'd stopped writhing, the dogs were tearing at them. A jar of caramel-colored honey sat on the kitchen table, cloudy with crystallized sugar. Edgar unscrewed the top and ran a finger's worth out, then topped a bowl of Wheaties extravagantly with it, and splashed milk over the top, and stood in the doorway and watched the dogs while he shoveled the concoction into his mouth. The bratwurst was gone almost before he started to eat. The dogs licked their chops and looked at him. "Okay," he signed. "Stand back." He set his cereal down and emptied the water bowl and dumped the contents of a half dozen cans of Campbell's chicken soup into it and several more of creamed corn. When his cereal was gone, their bowl had been licked clean as well. Then he walked onto the stoop with a bag of marshmallows. Three brilliant white cubes sailed through the air. He mashed one into his cheek, grinning evilly, and began another round. Halfway through the marshmallows, he was suddenly done. He gestured the dogs back into the kitchen and began to search the kitchen methodically, sorting the food into what he could take and what he should put back. When he finished, he pulled a brown grocery sack from a mass of them behind the refrigerator and stuffed it with their trash. He put the can opener into the silverware drawer and refilled the plastic bowl with water and let the dogs drink. They pushed lethargically to their feet, stomachs belled out. Suddenly he thought it was stupid to have let them eat so much after a long, hungry stretch that risked bloat. But they also risked starving, came the reply. He rinsed the water dish and put it under the cupboard where he'd found it. There was precious little they could take along, a bag of jelly beans, a flat, frosty package of bacon from the freezer. While he was looking in the freezer, he found a package of stew meat, also butcher-wrapped, but too big to carry. He set it in the refrigerator where the brats had been. A jelly jar with pencils and pens and packs of matches stood on the countertop by the door. Out of habit, he grabbed the matches, the Loot Bar and Grill, and dropped them into his shirt pocket. Then he searched the small bathroom off the kitchen. The medicine chest contained Bactine. He took it, and iodine and mercurochrome and a scattering of small adhesive bandages in their waxed envelopes. He left them, and gauze, but no off. The dogs were milling around the kitchen when he came out. He hustled them out the door and removed his muddy shoes, and then he washed the dishes and rearranged the kitchen and wetted the towel that lay draped over the back of a chair and wiped up the dirt they'd tracked in. When he finished, the kitchen looked reasonably like it had before they'd arrived. The kitchen clock read 1:15. He carried the paper bag containing the evidence of their crime to the trash can behind the shed, lifting a fly-strewn bag from on top and jamming his beneath. They retired to the field. He fetched the Zebco and the satchel and walked along the fence line. Halfway up the slope, the Loot water tower was visible again. He heard a rumble and noticed for the first time the railroad tracks at the bottom of the bluff beside the field. A freight train appeared from the south. Out on the road, the crossing bars dropped and the bell clanged. They watched a locomotive and 15 cars roll along. The tracks appeared to pass by Loot on a tangent. That was good luck, he thought. They might try walking the rails. But not just then. A postprandial lethargy had taken hold of Edgar, and he stumbled to where the dogs lay stretched out in the shade of the lone tree overhanging the fence. Tinder lay on his back, feet raised, in a posture of surrender. Babu and Esse faced the fence, chins on paws, gazes dreamily fixed on the horizon. As Edgar reached them, Esse heaved a roaring burp, licked her lips, and rolled onto her side. Edgar felt just the same. The sunflowers hid them nicely from the house. He sat down beside Babu and stroked his ruff until the dog's eyes drooped shut. Then Edgar lay back on the grass. When he woke, enormous cuneiform clouds had rolled across the sky, and between them great slant columns of afternoon sunlight tilted onto the earth. He yawned and sat up. He looked around. Though evening was well along, an hour or two of good light remained, he guessed. If they started at once and the traveling went easily, they might make several miles progress before bedding down again. His head throbbed from sleep or feast or both. The dogs, too, seemed dazed. They stood and yawned and shook themselves out and somehow slid down to the ground again. He let them lie and snuck downfield for another look at the house. Someone had recently arrived. A plain-looking sedan sat parked next to the stoop, and the trunk was hinged open, and a tall, lean man, maybe 30 years old, was hefting grocery bags out of its depths. The man had already been inside the house, for the back door stood open, but he seemed unalarmed. Edgar smiled to himself. He'd begun to take pride in his skill as a burglar. He had turned it into a kind of game. How much could he take before they noticed? How could he rearrange things to hide what was missing? People didn't expect someone to break into their houses and steal a little food. They expected to be ransacked, to lose televisions, money, cars, to find their dresser drawers dumped, their mattresses overturned. No one in the cabins, as far as he could tell, had ever done more than scratch their heads at their depleted larder. Who stole half a loaf of bread and then cleaned up after himself? Edgar and the dogs had feasted where this man now unpacked his groceries, and there was a chance he wouldn't even notice. When he returned, Edgar found the dog sniffing with great interest the package of bacon he'd taken from the kitchen of the little farmhouse. He looked at them and shook his head in disbelief. Edgar himself felt like one of those snakes that swallowed pigs whole. He didn't actually slosh as he walked, but the idea of putting more food inside his belly was laughable. He shooed them away, and they pranced backward and watched him while he stuffed their loot into the satchel. Then he grabbed the Zebco and led the dogs down the bluff. The railroad tracks veered to the northwest. A person could judge whether a train was coming, he'd read, by pressing an ear to one of the rails. And he tried it. The scored silver bar was warm but silent. The four of them trotted up the track far enough that a passing motorist wouldn't make much of them, a boy and some dogs. And then, as the night came on, he ambled along, tie to tie, feeling content and even swaggering a bit at the thought of their success raiding the farm. Scrub wood paralleled the tracks left and right. Far ahead, a low, uncovered bridge waited in the gloaming. Stories came back to him of people struck by trains as they walked the rails, and he wondered how that was possible. Wouldn't anyone hear a train thundering toward him long before it arrived? He hoped one would come by just so he could count off the seconds between the first sound of it and when it passed. These were his thoughts when Tinder first cried out, a yike of surprise and pain that made Edgar's stomach instantly knot in fear. He knew where each of the dogs was. Esse and Babu had been poking along beside him on the ties, as content and lost in thought as he. But Tinder had trotted down the grade to investigate something in a stand of cattails. Probably frogs, Edgar had thought. He even recalled seeing, from the corner of his eye, Tinder stiffen and pounce. But his attention had been directed up the tracks, imagining onrushing trains. Tinder's motion had looked unexceptional. The dogs pounced dozens of times each day on toads, frogs, field mice, grasshoppers, who knew what. But this time Tinder let out a shrill, "ay, ay," and leapt back. Edgar stood watching, unable at first to move, as the dog tried to set his foot down. Tinder shrieked and threw himself down amidst the cattails, holding his right paw in the air and striking at it with his left. Snake bite was Edgar's first coherent thought. Somehow that finally broke his paralysis. He crashed through the weeds below the embankment and dropped to his knees beside Tinder. But even before he touched the dog, he saw the blue-green shard of glass, muddy and jagged, impaled on the bottom of the dog's foot, and the thin spear protruding from the top. Out of reflex, Edgar grabbed Tinder's muzzle. In the days to come, he would remember that instinctive motion and think he had at least done one thing right, because Tinder was about to bite the glass and would have gashed his mouth as badly as his foot. Tinder shook off his grip and tried to scramble up. Edgar threw a leg over the dog and rolled him. Tinder lashed his body side to side, kicking a fine crimson spray over them. Then Edgar felt Tinder's teeth on his forearm. But there was no time to see if he'd been bitten, or how badly. Somehow he got himself kneeling over the dog. Esse and Babu had plunged down the embankment alongside him, and they danced at Tinder's muzzle, worrying and licking his mouth. For a moment, Tinder's body went slack as he looked at the other dogs. Now, Edgar thought, knowing he might not get another chance. He gripped Tinder's paw tightly and grasped the crudely serrated wedge of glass between his thumb and forefinger and pulled. There was a horrible sawing as the speared point slid back into Tinder's foot. The glass was slick with blood and mud, and Edgar's thumb slipped along the edge. Had Tinder not jerked his foot back, the tearing sensation in Edgar's thumb would have made him release the shard before it was out of the dog's pad. He felt Tinder's teeth on his forearm, this time harder, but by then it was already done. He dropped the piece of glass and rolled and lay on his side, squeezing his hand and looking at the ragged incision that had appeared in the fleshy front of his thumb. The cut burned like acid, and he shook his hand to slake it. Tinder hobbled away and sank to the ground near the embankment. If the sensation in Edgar's thumb was any measure, Tinder must have been in agony. Edgar curled his thumb into his fist and ran to the dog, blood dripping from between his fingers. He sat panting. Esse and Babu were nosing through the cattails, swiping their tails in curiosity. He stood again and ran to them, panicked at the idea of more broken glass, clapping his hands until blood splashed across his shirt. He hustled the dogs back toward Tinder, where they scented the dog along his legs and sides until they were certain they had located his wound. The shard of glass lay in the weeds. Edgar picked it up. The broad end had three smooth ridges, threads for a jar cap. A fragment of a jelly jar or something like that, pitched into the weeds from a passing train or by another walker of ties. Bloody dirt packed the threads. He flung it angrily into the cattails and forced his thumb out straight and pulled open the gash to look at it. He felt a thump, and then he was sitting. Esse was nosing him and licking his face. When his vision stopped tunneling, he pushed himself to his feet, wobbled, and sank to his knees. Wait, he thought, drawing a breath. Try again. On his next attempt, he was able to stand. He staggered over to Tinder, who lay with his paw curled inward before him, as if cradling some orphaned part of his body, sorrowfully drawing his tongue across the pad. His pelt contracted where Edgar lay a hand on it. Tinder turned away from his injury momentarily to look at Edgar. With his good hand, Edgar stroked the dog from the top of his head down along his backbone. He palpated Tinder's back feet, hoping he would understand what was coming. Then Edgar ran his hand along Tinder's foreleg again, this time all the way to his pad, without a protest from the dog beyond a short rumble of apprehension and a lick. A crescent-shaped wound lay in the center of the triangular middle pad, oozing blood and dirt. Edgar didn't attempt to touch it, but slowly, very slowly, rotated the paw until he could look at the blood-stained fur on top. He delicately touched the tips of Tinder's claws, one by one, manipulating his toes. When he touched the second toe, Tinder whined and jerked his foot. So that was it. Something in his second toe. Maybe not the bone, but there were ligaments, tendons, tiny muscles in there. He released Tinder's leg and stroked him and tried to think. He bent his thumb experimentally. It didn't hurt more bent than straight, which was a good sign, but they could both probably use stitches. He stood, still wobbly, and retreated a few paces, bringing Esse and Babu around behind him. Tinder lay watching, ears back, as if he knew what Edgar was about to ask of him. Come, Edgar signed. Tinder looked at him. He whined, then stood on three legs and held his damaged forefoot in the air, nosing it like a broken thing.
Edgar knelt. "I'm sorry," he sighed. "We have to do this."
Then he recalled Tinder again. Tinder set his foot on the ground and jerked it up. He hobbled a step, looked at Edgar, and tried again. When he finally reached Edgar, he dropped to the ground, panting, and refusing to meet Edgar's gaze, even when Edgar put his face in front of his. He might be going into shock, Edgar thought. He ran a fingertip along Tinder's gums. They were moist, which was good, but it was obvious that the dog couldn't walk. Edgar got Tinder to his feet by slipping a hand under his belly. He passed one arm behind the dog's back legs and threaded the other under his chest, careful not to touch his dangling foot. He thought if he did it wrong, Tinder might bite him out of panic. And if he dropped the dog, he knew he wouldn't be granted a second try. But Tinder panted in his face and waited, and Edgar came smoothly to his feet. Slowly he made his way up the side of the railroad embankment, digging the toe of each shoe into the gravel before trusting his weight on it. Once on top, he could take only one small step at a time, for fear of tripping on a tie. His thumb throbbed as if it had burst. Tinder hung slack in his arms, as if he'd concluded that this was how things would have to go. And that, if nothing else, made Edgar realize how badly the dog's paw had been mangled. Then he remembered the Zebco and the fisherman's satchel lying beside the tracks. He didn't turn back for them. It would be impossible to carry them anyway, and the dark was quickly becoming absolute. He'd have to go back later. Far in the distance, headlights glowed, then faded as a car crossed the railroad tracks beneath the bluff they had descended. He focused on that point and took another step. Before they reached the blacktop, he'd had to set Tinder down three times to let the knots in his back unkink. The dog was heavy, 90 pounds or more, over half Edgar's own weight. Each time they stopped, Tinder tried to walk, managing only to hobble a few yards before lying down. The lucky thing, if that was what it could be called, was that they had gone only about a mile down the track. Essay and Babu had stuck close by, another good thing, since Edgar had no way of signing a recall with his arms full. He picked up Tinder. They began again. Then they stood on the deserted blacktop. The only light came from the windows of the little four-square house beneath the sunflower field. The adrenaline that had first powered Edgar had ebbed, and he staggered along with Tinder in his arms. The asphalt was wonderfully flat and smooth beneath his feet. When they reached the mailbox, Edgar walked up the driveway under the row of tall trees in the front yard. The air around the house was alight with fireflies. A June bug buzzed past. Essay and Babu charged ahead and rounded the corner of the house. The moment they disappeared, Tinder began to squirm and Edgar walked faster. Essay and Babu were milling about on the unlit stoop when he got there. He knelt and guided Tinder down onto the wooden planks. Then he clapped softly and led Essay and Babu a few feet onto the grass and down them as well. When he turned back, a man's face had appeared in the window above the kitchen sink. The porch light flared. Edgar checked the dogs. They lay at attention, watching. The inside door swung open, and the man he'd watched carrying groceries from his car that evening looked at him through the screen. "Can I help you?" the man said. His gaze fell on Tinder, panting on the stoop. He looked at Edgar and saw the blood. "You've been in an accident?" Edgar shook his head and signed a response. The man wasn't going to understand sign, but there was no better way to get started. With luck, he'd understand he was being signed at. "My dog's hurt. We need help." The man watched Edgar's hands. Edgar waited while he figured it out. "You're deaf," he said. He shook his head. "You can hear me?" "Yes." Then Edgar gestured toward his throat and shook his head. He made as if to write on his palm. The man looked at him blankly, then said,
Oh, got it. Right, just a second.
And disappeared into the house, leaving Edgar to stare into the kitchen he'd ransacked that morning. His legs trembled as he waited. He knelt by Tinder and stroked his ruff, and watched as the dog tongued his wounded paw in long strokes, eyes glassy and unfocused, as if staring into another world. In the yellow porch light, his bloody fur gleamed black. Then Edgar went to Esse and Babu and set his hands intimately under their jaws, touching them the way he would if everything were okay, and together they watched the doorway. The man returned. He stood behind the screen, holding a pencil and a pad. His gaze went to Tinder, then to Edgar, squatting beside the two other dogs. Evidently, he hadn't noticed Esse and Babu before.
"Whoa," he said.
He put his palm forward and patted the air, as if trying to make everything stay still while he took stock of things.
"Okay, okay. Definitely, definitely not an ordinary situation," he said, giving Esse and Babu a wary gaze. "They're friendly?"
Edgar nodded. For the man's benefit, he turned and stayed them. There was something morose about the man, Edgar thought. It was an odd idea to have about someone he'd just met, but an unmistakable aura of resignation enveloped the man, as though he were one of those people depicted in cartoons who walked around with rain clouds over their heads, people whose change fell out of their pockets when they bent down to pick up a penny. The man's reaction to Esse and Babu only reinforced this impression, as if he'd somehow been expecting to find a pack of ferocious dogs outside his door one day. He didn't smile. His expression was guarded, though not unfriendly. But he didn't frown, either. If anything, his eyes conveyed a look of benign misgiving, the result of some lifelong despondency.
"Right," he said. "Trained. But friendly, yes?"
"Yes." He peered into the dark.
"Any more out there?"
Edgar shook his head, and he'd have smiled if his stomach hadn't been churning with anxiety. The man opened the screen door and stepped out, fixing the dogs with a doubtful look. Edgar took the pencil and the pad.
"My dog cut his foot. I need water to clean it, and a pan or bucket."
They looked down at Tinder.
"Are any people hurt?"
"No."
"I should call the doctor,"
the man said. Edgar shook his head vehemently.
"What's wrong with your voice? Did you hurt your throat somehow?"
"No."
"You've always been that way?"
"Yes."
The man thought for a second.
"Okay, wait, I'll be right back," he said.
He walked inside. Edgar heard some clanking and rattling, and then water running in the kitchen sink. In a moment, the man emerged carrying a white enamel pot, water sloshing over the sides. A ratty blue towel was tucked under his arm.
"Here," he said, setting the pot down on the planks of the stoop. "It's warm. You can get started with this. I'll get you a bucket and see what else I've got."
Edgar carried the pot to Tinder and ladled up a handful of water and held it out for the dog to smell. Tinder was panting hard, and he licked the water from his fingers. Edgar dipped the rag into the water and ran his hand down Tinder's foreleg. The dog whined and poked his nose at Edgar anxiously, but let him dab at the dirt on his foot. Edgar rinsed the rag. The water clouded and turned brown. He pressed his face to Tinder's muzzle while he soaked the cloth against Tinder's pad again and again. Each time, the rag came away covered with a mixture of blood and muck. The man emerged carrying a metal bucket and walked to a spigot that projected from the house's foundations. It squeaked when he turned it on. Fresh water sprayed out. While the bucket was filled, he turned to Edgar.
"If I bring this over, will it spook your dog?"
Edgar had his arm over Tinder's back. He didn't think a stranger's approach would scare him, but it was a good question to ask, and his opinion of the man went up a notch.
"No."
The man toted the bucket over and set it a cautious distance away and sat. The water in the small enamel pot was gritty and brown.
The man reached over and tipped the dirty water out and dipped it into the bucket and returned it. Esse and Babu groaned behind Edgar. It had been a mistake to place them where his back would be turned, making them more likely to break their stays out of curiosity. He sat up straight, keeping one hand on Tinder's withers, and gestured at the man to stay still. The man nodded. Edgar turned and looked at the two dogs, who tucked their feet and locked gazes with him. "Come," he signed. They bounded forward. Edgar worried that Tinder would forget his wound and rise to meet them, but the pressure of his hand between the dog's shoulder blades kept him steady. Esse and Babu charged around them, heads reared back to get close with their chests, while taking the stranger in widely.
"I hope you meant it when you said they were friendly," the man said.
He was sitting very straight, trying to look at them both at once. Then he gave up and just looked at whichever dog happened to be in front of him.
"Whoa, buddy," he muttered. "Okay, okay."
When they discharged enough of their curiosity, Edgar clapped and gestured to a spot in the grass nearby. At first they refused. Edgar clapped again, and they trotted over, grumbling. He'd selected a spot where they could watch what was going on, and he felt them relax now that they could make eye contact with him. He turned back to cleaning Tinder's paw. The fresh water had dirtied again, though now more bloody than brown.
"You're hurt, too," the man said.
Edgar nodded. His thumb blazed each time he dipped it into the wash water, but it reminded him how Tinder felt when he dabbed the cold cloth across his paw.
"What happened?"
Edgar stopped washing Tinder's paw long enough to pantomime spiking the flat of one hand on two fingers of another.
"Ugh, ouch," the man said.
He watched in silence for a while.
"Okay," he said at last. "Tell you what, I'm going back inside to see what I've got in my medicine cabinet. Here, let me get that."
He reached over and dumped the pan and refilled it from the bucket again.
"I might have mercurochrome or hydrogen peroxide."
Edgar concentrated entirely on Tinder now. He'd cleaned most of the dirt away, and he needed to swab between Tinder's toes and around the pad. He maneuvered the dog's paw so that he could submerge it in the small pan entirely. The water turned brown. Tinder yelped and jerked, but Edgar slowly worked his fingers between Tinder's toes again, dumping the water several times while the man was gone. Then the man was squatting down in front of them. He set down a metal pan wrapped with tinfoil, on top of which lay a collection of bottles retrieved from his medicine chest. One of them was Tylenol. He opened the bottle and held out two capsules.
"Maybe you should take a couple of these," he said.
Edgar popped them into the back of Tinder's mouth at once, and pointed the dog's muzzle upward and stroked his throat until his tongue swiped his nose. Then he scooped up a handful of clear water from the bucket and let Tinder lap it. The man nodded. He held out two more capsules, which Edgar quickly swallowed.
"Right," the man said. "Also, I've got something these guys might be interested in."
He folded back the foil and lifted a hunk of brown stew meat between his thumb and forefinger, the meat Edgar had taken from the freezer that morning to replace the stolen bratwurst.
"I just made this tonight. It's even a little warm yet."
Edgar nodded and released the two watchers. There was a time, he thought, when the dogs would have checked with him before accepting food from a stranger. They'd been drilled on it in town. But that was a remnant of a life long gone, cast aside by animals who hunted frogs and snakes and ate ripe turtle eggs. Esse and Babu arranged themselves around the man, ears up, waiting their turn as he flicked hunks of glistening beef onto the grass. The man acted almost bashful under their combined gaze. With trepidation, he allowed Tinder to take the meat directly from his hands. But Edgar was grateful for any distraction that allowed him to more thoroughly wash Tinder's wound. When the meat was gone, the man let Tinder lick the gravy off his fingers and pushed the pan out with his foot for the other dogs to clean up.
He had a wry expression on his face. Edgar got the feeling this might be the happiest the man could look.
"Call it what you will," the man said, "but this is definitely not ordinary."
Henry. With Edgar's hands occupied, the conversation remained lopsided. Esse and Babu lay in the grass, sated, observing the proceedings by the glow of the moth-crossed porch light. Edgar lifted Tinder's paw and examined the flayed wound in the center of his swollen, heart-shaped pad.
"Geez, that's gruesome," the man said, as Edgar dabbed Tinder's foot. "You'll be lucky ever to use that thing again." After another moment's thought, he added, "Your thumb doesn't look so great either."
Edgar replaced the water in the enamel pan and went back to washing Tinder's paw. Threads of blood diffused into the water. The outside tap water was icy, but that was okay. He wanted it as cold as possible. If he could barely feel his hands, maybe Tinder would barely feel his injury. He worked the bones of Tinder's foot, lifting and pressing the toes like piano keys, tracing Tinder's nails with his own, pressing his fingertips into the soft caves between the pads. Gently, gently, he opened the incision, letting the dog tell him where the pain was. When Tinder snatched his paw away, Edgar closed his eyes and pressed his face into Tinder's ruff, stroking his chest and jaw, listening to the rush of blood through the dog's neck, making Tinder realize how important the water was, asking over and over if they could try just once more. After a time, Tinder let Edgar lift his foot back into the pan. Edgar waited until his fingers numbed, then began to rock the wound open, let the water flush it clean again. When he opened his eyes, the pan had been refilled with fresh, cold water.
"That's really something," the man said. "Sometimes I can't tell whether it's you or the dog moving his foot."
Edgar nodded.
"You know him real well, huh?"
"Yes."
"Same with the other dogs?"
"Yes."
"It's okay that he's got his teeth on your arm like that?"
Edgar nodded. "Yes, yes." He continued to work Tinder's foot. When the water stayed clear, he sorted through the medicines on the stoop. He dumped the hydrogen peroxide into the pan, pouring it over Tinder's paw. It fizzed at Tinder's pad and the pursed white flesh on Edgar's thumb. When the fizzing stopped, he propped Tinder's paw over his leg and patted it dry. The man went inside and returned with a towel and a rag and some scissors.
"I don't have gauze, but if you want, you can wrap it in this," he said.
Edgar nodded and took the pencil and paper.
"Do you have a sock?" he wrote.
"Right," the man said, and disappeared into the house again.
He cut the rag into strips and wrapped Tinder's foot and tied off the ends of the bandages so they wouldn't come loose. The man returned with a white sock in his hand. Edgar secured it with the last strip.
"Okay, look," the man said. "I need sleep. Work tomorrow."
He looked doubtfully at the dogs.
"I'm guessing you won't go inside without them."
"No."
The man nodded as if accepting another in a long series of humiliations. "Tell me they're housebroken. Lie if you have to."
Edgar nodded.
"All right, come on. We'll figure out what's next in the morning."
Edgar called Babu and Esse and hastily washed their feet. The man held the door, bleakly ceremonious, as the dogs trotted over, raising their noses at the threshold to scent the air, and walked into the kitchen. Edgar knelt and arranged Tinder in his arms and staggered sideways through the doorway.
"Left," the man said.
Edgar sidestepped along a short hall. Tinder sniffed at the coats hanging from the hooks as they passed. Then he was standing in a living room with a sofa, an overstuffed chair, bookcases, and a television with a phonograph on top. The floors were beat-up hardwood, deeply grooved and darkened with age.
He lowered Tinder to a throw rug in front of the sofa. The dog tried to stand, but Edgar lifted his front feet from under him and set him down again. By the time the man appeared with a pillow and a pair of blankets, he had all the dogs down and stayed.
"Here," the man said. "I'd appreciate it if you slept with one of those blankets under you, what with the mud and everything."
Edgar looked down at himself and realized that, though he had cleaned up the dogs, he was covered with a mixture of dried blood and dirt.
"Get some sleep. Not that I think you need me to tell you. You're swaying. You know that, right? The bad news is I have to be up early tomorrow for work. There's a bathroom off the kitchen. I put some band-aids and some antibiotic goop on the end table, if you want to take care of that thumb."
Edgar nodded. The man took another long look at the dogs.
"When they start chewing on things, try to steer them over to that chair, would you?"
He jerked his thumb at an overstuffed armchair in the corner. It was upholstered in orange and brown. Images of ducks were involved in the pattern.
"I hate that chair," he said.
Edgar looked at him, trying to decide if he was making a joke.
"By the way," he said, "my name's Henry Lamb."
He held out his hand. Edgar shook it, and then Henry walked to the doorway off the living room and turned and looked back.
"I don't suppose you have people you want called? Family? Someone to come get you?"
"No."
"Yep," Henry grunted. "Had to ask."
Edgar was too tired to wash up. He spread the blanket over the couch and lay down. His head ached with fatigue. His thumb just plain ached. He took the band-aids and slathered antibiotic ointment over the raw and puckered wound on his thumb. He was still trying to decide if he had the energy to turn out the light when a wave of exhaustion swept him away, the ointment and the band-aid wrappers still lying on his chest. The sofa should have been a rare pleasure. Instead, his sleep was plagued by absences. Why did the night withhold its panoply of sounds? Where were the bodies of the dogs that warmed him in the dark? He drifted near sleep like a buoy off a shore, until sometime in the night the great rock python Ka materialized and looped his iridescent coils around Edgar's legs and chest. It was comforting to meet a figure he recognized, yet how oddly like cotton Ka's reptilian skin felt under his fingertips, warm and downy, and shot through in places with something almost like a turned hem. The wedge of Ka's head swayed before him, lisping nonsense. But even that master hypnotist couldn't draw him deeper into sleep. Missing dogs, smothering quiet, snake's coils. When dogs began to bark, Edgar jumped up, electrified by the alarm in their voices. He didn't bother to disentangle himself from what he knew to be a dream figment, but somehow Ka had passed into the waking world and taken the form of a blanket wrapped tightly around his legs. Considering how briefly he remained vertical, Edgar gleaned an admirable amount of information about the situation. There was Essay and Babu and Tinder